This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, welcome back to New Books Network. This is your host, Shu Wan. So today I feel very happy to invite Dr. Sullivan to join us to introduce his news about podcasting in a platform age. So the first question I want to do is to invite Dr. Sullivan to introduce himself to us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm a big fan of the New Books Network, and I have a former host of the New Books Network as well. So it's really great to be back here with you. I'll just introduce you to myself. My name is John Sullivan. I am a professor of media and communication at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the United States. And my main research interest is on media industries. And in particular, I've been focusing for the last few years, really, since 2016, on the emerging podcasting industry. So I just completed a book that we're talking about today called Podcasting in a Platform Age. And my teaching and research interests, as I say, are on media industries. I have done some previous work on open source software communities, and I've also looked at the structure of the cable television industry back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and now I'm focusing almost exclusively on the emerging podcasting industry, so it's great to be here.
Oh, thanks so much for your answer. So as you mentioned, like you work as a host of the New Books Network, and you are a podcaster. So for this one, I'm wondering why, here's my question. I'm wondering if your experience of doing podcasting motivated you to study podcast as a phenomenon, as a research subject.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I actually started getting interested in podcasting when I was working on a previous project. I mentioned that I had done some work on free and open sourced software communities. So in the aughts, between around 2006 and 2009, I was really focused on open source software communities. And in particular, I was looking for places where these programmers, developers, and users exchange information about what they use, how they use software, and what are some of the ethics and values surrounding open source software. And it was at that point that I discovered for the first time that they were communicating a lot through this relatively new medium called podcasting. So I started, I taught myself how to, subscribe to RSS feeds, and I started listening to open source software podcasts. And that was my focus for a few years. So I was listening to a lot of the early podcasts that were very tech-focused and tech-heavy. And it wasn't until around 2012, 2013, once that project was complete, that I started getting interested in podcasting in its own right, as its own emerging medium. And then, of course, Serial happened in 2014. And suddenly the floodgates were open to millions of new listeners to podcasts. And I started witnessing a transformation of podcasting from this kind of amateur medium that was only known to a few because of some of the technical barriers that were involved in listening to a much more mainstream medium. And that really became my focus for the next several years.
Thank you so much for your answer. So now let's turn to your book. For the first question, I want to invite you to talk about how to understand in podcast with the, I mean, just give us a big picture of how to understand podcasting in a longer and a larger historical context of audio distribution via the internet.
Great. That's such a fascinating topic. And it's not something that I spend too much time talking about the book, because we actually have some excellent scholarship in the field of sonic studies and audio studies. One book in particular that I lean heavily on in the early chapter of my book is a book called Sound Streams by Andrew Bottomley, which is a really great overview of the history of internet radio, going all the way back to the 1990s and then moving through the early 21st century. So the idea to package audio on the internet is as old as the internet itself, right? So even in the early 1990s, when the internet was just sort of rolling out and WWW Tim Berners-Lee introduced that, there was excitement about potentially, eventually, using the internet as a medium for both audio and video transmission. But at the time, the bandwidth was just so, so limited that it wasn't a real possibility. So there were technical barriers to doing that. So Bottomley talks about how RSS, which is the distribution mechanism for podcasting, was invented really around 2000, 2001, for not just subscribing to blogs, which is what its main purpose was, but then software programmer Dave Weiner, along with former MTV VJ Adam Curry, worked together to develop the idea of RSS enclosure, which is to use the RSS feed to link to audio files that were stored on the web. And the idea was to then link to these files, to download them at night so you could leave your computer going overnight because speeds were incredibly slow. And then when you woke up the next morning, you would have a series of audio files on your computer that you could connect to a portable digital device. At the time, the most popular was the iPod, but there were competitors like Microsoft Zune and others. And then the idea was you would have on-demand audio that you could carry with you. So RSS really is the driving force behind podcasting, or at least it has been up until about 5 or 6 years ago. So that's really I really focus in on the importance of RSS, not just as part of podcasting's history, but as part of podcasting's identity, because RSS is an open standard. Anybody can use it. You don't have to pay a royalty or a fee or get permission to use it. So software developers can piggyback on RSS to develop their own apps to deliver content to users. And it's spurred an enormous amount of innovation as a result of it being completely open to everyone. And it has also fueled a kind of ethos around podcasting that is very open to amateurs, open to anyone at all to upload and share content. And it's this kind of do-it-yourself or DIY ethos is something I talk about in the book that is part of, or has been part of, podcasting's identity.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. It's very interesting when I read a book. Before reading a book, I have already know RSS, this kind of thing, because it's, I still remember like 20 years ago, maybe less than 20 years ago, I used RSS for, subscription of news and blog, but the first time after reading a book, in the early history of podcasting, RSS was so important. So then for the next question, I want to invite you to map the current landscape of podcasting within the Turo's Power Roles framework.
Okay, great. So let me just say briefly that the approach to the book really is to look at some of the emerging industry players for podcasting. And to help me understand that, I have leveraged a kind of theoretical tool from the 80s and 90s called The Power Roles Framework, which is developed by Joseph Chereau at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School. I was a student of Dr. Chereau's when I was there to finish my graduate degree and work closely with him. And this framework is a really nice framework for thinking about how industries are organized, how they share and compete for resources, and ultimately how much power they have in the marketplace. So that was the guiding principle to think about podcasting and who is involved in podcasting. So today, right, podcasting is really developed into a whole network of different companies and organizations that have suddenly become very interested in distributing on-demand audio through the internet. The umbrella term for this is podcasting, but the reality is the emergence of the importance of video streaming, not just on YouTube, but of course on platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Paramount Plus, Disney Plus, all of these other streaming services, has changed consumers' habits. And now streaming is the number one distribution mechanism for most of our commercial media today. Streaming is where audiences are listening to it. So in that sense, podcasting was ahead of the curve because podcasting was offering on-demand audio as early as 2004, 2005, predating most of our streaming services. So as the whole nexus of the listener experience and the audience experience has shifted towards streaming, many of the radio and audio broadcasters, along with tech companies, following the success of Serial, became quite interested in investing heavily in the podcasting space. And perhaps the most significant of these audio and tech companies was the Swedish audio streaming giant Spotify, which starting in 2018, 2019, started a deluge of mergers, acquisitions, buyouts in a bid to position itself as the number one supplier or distributor of not just recorded music, but of spoken word podcasts and audio. And following on Spotify's moves, a number of US companies that are radio companies, like iHeartMedia and SiriusXM, the satellite radio company, started their own acquisitions within the podcasting space and started launching, in the case of iHeartMedia, literally hundreds of podcasts to bankroll their production, to basically try and compete with Spotify in the space. So that's really transformed podcasting, and the really focus of the book is looking at some of the emergence of these big media players in podcasting, and also the move away from RSS and towards streaming as a method for distributing podcasts.
Okay, so much. Thanks so much for your answer again. So for the next question, I want to invite you to talk about like the centrality of Apple to the distribution of podcast. While I want to say I also used Apple Podcast to listen to my favorite podcasts, especially those on the New Books Network, but I'm still wondering how and the why.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that. Apple has always been at the center of the podcast ecosystem, and it really has to do with, I mean, Apple was the first tech company to jump on podcasts and to integrate podcasting into its iTunes service all the way back in 2005. And it's not too much of a stretch to say that we probably have Apple to thank for popularizing podcasts to millions of users. And Apple's calculus was very simple here. They wanted to make the value of their iPods, which were a top-selling tech hardware for digital audio at the time, they wanted to make those objects and those products that much more useful and attractive to potential buyers. So the more content you could store and access on those devices, the more useful they became. So for then CEO Steve Jobs, podcasting was a way for iPod users to access free content, right? And to therefore increase the value proposition of iPods. And by integrating RSS distribution into the iTunes desktop software in 2005, Apple made it incredibly easy to subscribe to a podcast and to download podcast content. So it basically removed any technical barrier, so to speak, from the general population to access podcasting. But then what happened afterwards was a little bit strange because Apple basically integrated podcasting and then took an entirely hands-off approach to podcasting for the next decade or more. The reason for that likely is that Apple did not see itself at the time as a content company. They were a technology company. They sold hardware. They sold software in the sense that they bundled their Mac operating system or their iOS operating system into their hardware sales, but they were not a content company. At the time, they were simply interested in expanding the versatility and usefulness of their hardware in a bid to sell hardware. So Apple is a leader in podcasting, but it's not necessarily or hasn't historically done very much with that incredible head start in being involved in podcasting. That has changed so much. Now, Apple is offering some of its podcasters a way to put paywalls up behind podcast content to basically allow users to monetize their content through Apple Podcasts, which is their new branded service so it branched off from iTunes to become Apple Podcasts. And Apple is also doing more to distribute its user data, which we'll talk about, I think, in a second, to podcasters and advertisers alike, because it gathers lots of data about who's listening to podcasts and how much of those podcasts they're listening to. So Apple is an incredibly important player in the podcasting ecosystem. It is not necessarily monetizing or trying to monetize podcasts in a way that some of the other big tech players are trying to do. But it nevertheless plays a very important role in the podcasting ecosystem, if for no other reason than it has a default podcast app that is installed on each and every iPhone that's sold, which makes it that little purple app with the RSS logo on it, which makes it incredibly easy for any iPhone user around the globe to access podcast content, subscribe to it, download it, and listen to it.
Much for your answer. For next question, I'm wondering about the notion of professionalism in podcasting and its use in case studies.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one of my key arguments in the book, is that what's happening along with these big companies, these big tech companies and radio and audio companies taking an active interest in podcasting. They're not just investing in podcasting. They're not just making deals with podcast producers to lock up some content like the Joe Rogan Experience, which is still the number one podcast. Spotify made sure that it made a multi-year, multi-million dollar deal with Joe Rogan to make sure that Spotify could be the exclusive provider of his content to listeners. But what these companies are bringing with them as well is a certain style of working, right? A certain level of professionalism, you might say, certain kinds of work practices that look such that the product of what you get, what you hear on podcasts, is not necessarily the same kind of rough around the edges, relatively unedited speaking that you hear on most podcasts, but instead it's sounding much more similar to commercial radio. It's very professionally edited. There are sound effects. There are whole production teams that are being used to create podcasts. So the audio experience for listeners is a much more seamless, professional experience than what you might have heard 10 years or 15 years prior. So those kinds of developments are changing our expectations for what a podcast should be, what it should sound like. And it's also putting pressure, therefore, on amateur producers because their content is suddenly now being placed up against this much more professional content on the distribution directories where you find podcasts. And that is moving the whole medium maybe a little bit away from its DIY roots and more towards a professionalized medium.
I'm sorry. Thanks so much for your answer again. So for the next question, let's move to the largest annual convention of podcasts in the United States, Podcast Movement. I'm wondering about, the interaction or interaction between the theme of entrepreneurism and the discuss of formalization and the specialization there.
Yeah, so that's all those terms I use in the book, right? So formalization would be like the adoption of certain kinds of formal structures, both external structures, like of the media companies that are there moving into the industry, and trickling down even into the types of labor roles that you see in media. So the specialization is the sort of creation of all these new positions and jobs that have emerged as a result of the formalization of podcasting. So beginning in 2016, I started attending an annual conference of podcasters. And let me be clear, there are lots of different conferences and annual conventions dedicated to podcasting, not just in the US, but around the world. So this was just a microcosm, you might say, of what's happening within podcasting. But this conference called Podcast Movement was created as a means to bring people together to talk about podcasting. And I started attending this annual conference in 2016. And each and every year, I noticed more and more people in suits with professional titles and backgrounds coming from the major media companies and corporations, having a larger presence at this conference, and on the flip side, a much smaller presence of independent podcasters, right? These are the people who podcast as a hobby or maybe hope to or aspire to podcast full time, but simply can't do so yet because they're not making enough money at it. So I noticed fewer and fewer of those people and more of the professional suits, so to speak, showing up at this conference. And with it came a kind of entrepreneurial ethos, right? This idea that anybody can cross over from being an amateur independent podcaster to being a professional podcaster if you do things the way we do them in radio, if you work hard enough, if you are attentive to your audience, if you have an active social media presence, if you engage your audience, not just through your content, but also through other types of means like having a newsletter or having another kind of online presence like a blog or a website. So all these kinds of messages that independent podcasters were told at these conferences were all about picking yourself up by your bootstraps and making it in the digital economy. And this is similar to what we see happening in a lot of other types of online media. We see this happening with social media influencers, right? We see this happening in sites like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, right? So there's all kinds of academic literature about how these forms of online, amateur online cultural production are starting to blur into semi-professional production. At the same time, creating a kind of blowback or an uncertainty among these producers about their ability to compete as professionals.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer again. So for the next question, this one is about the sixth chapter of your book. This chapter is my favorite one because, you know, some of my listeners, you may imagine, like for me as a podcast, two of my biggest concerns are, one, how many subscribers this month of my podcast this month, if the number is larger than last month. Two, how many people, listen to my podcast if the number is larger than last month. If the answer of the two questions are no, I mean, the Dharma know I'm in a big trouble. So for this chapter, the chapter 6 of the book, you talk about debate over the audience metrics in podcasting and its meaning for the future of podcast. So I want you to talk about this chapter.
Yeah, thanks. This is such a fascinating topic, and it's important to podcasters, but also to the industry as a whole. So as the industry has expanded and formalized, it's also, and this kind of goes together with a discussion of how podcasts make money, how they are monetized, right? So the medium itself is really geared around advertising. And advertisers in all forms of online media, and increasingly in podcasting, are becoming much more interested in knowing who is listening to podcasts, not just how many downloads you have, but who is actually listening to your podcast. So, and this is where we're reaching some of the interesting inflection points in the industry, because RSS as a distribution mechanism was always designed to make the distribution of podcasts easy for listeners. It was never designed with surveillance in mind. In fact, RSS is a completely agnostic medium. It may keep track of where you're accessing the audio file from in terms of your IP address and maybe some basic information about what kind of device you're accessing that media on. But that's about the extent to which RSS can tell podcasters or advertisers or anyone about who is accessing your content. So traditionally, podcasters like you would have access to, number one, how many people subscribe to your podcast. Does that mean they're listening to your podcast? Not necessarily, but they subscribe to it. And the second metric that had always been used for podcasts was how many downloads do you have per episode? Apple, iPods, and later iPhones, once you subscribe to a podcast, they had been downloading the latest 5 episodes of that podcast for you to listen on demand by default. They just stopped doing that last year and created huge waves in the industry. But it was a means to try and describe to advertisers that not all people who download your episode are actually listening to it. So neither of those two numbers gives you a metric of consumption. And that's really what advertisers want. They want to know, did you hit play on that podcast? How much of that podcast did you listen to? And perhaps most importantly, did you make it halfway through the podcast where we've embedded our mid-roll advertisement? And did you make it to the end of the podcast where we have another advertisement for you? So those are the kinds of things that advertisers want to know. RSS is less well-equipped to provide you with that information. So companies like Spotify and iHeartMedia and others that are streaming platforms primarily have access to all that data because they know you need to have a subscription in order to be on those platforms. So the platform knows exactly who you are, what you're accessing, when you're accessing it, how much of the content you're accessing. And in that sense, they have a leg up or they have an advantage on RSS because they can provide all that data to advertisers. That means that the future of an advertising-driven medium is going to be very much run through those platforms as a way to make money on podcasts. That's going to put RSS and independent podcasting at a distinct disadvantage. So one of the things I talk about in the later chapters of the book is this dynamic that's emerging whereby the pressures of the advertising industry are changing the dynamics of podcasting to centralize the importance of platform services like Spotify as key intermediaries in the distribution of podcasting.
So thanks so much for your answer. For last question, as you mentioned, the last chapter of the book is about money. So let's talk about money or monetization of podcasting.
Yeah, there's so many different ways that you can make money on podcasts, right? Podcasters have been doing this for a very, very long time. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book is to outline some of these strategies, right? Podcasters are incredibly innovative. Indie podcasters are incredibly innovative people. They come up with all kinds of mechanisms for helping to offset the costs that are usually involved in producing a podcast. So they might sell branded mugs or t-shirts. These days, many social media creators and podcasters and YouTubers might subscribe to a service for peer-to-peer monetization. Services like Patreon or Buy Me a Coffee that ask your users to contribute a small amount, either one time or a recurring contribution. That's another way that many small creators are finding to offset their costs, not necessarily to make it a full-time job, but to provide enough income to offset some of the production costs that they incur and the time that it takes them to produce the content. But those are relatively small amounts of money. Granted, there are a few people who are making lots of money on Patreon, but those people are very, very few and far between. Where the bulk of the revenue is coming into the industry is through traditional advertising, digital advertising. This comes in two forms. Number one, it comes in the form of what we call host-read advertising or baked-in advertising. That's when you, as the host of a podcast, would get a script from a potential advertiser, and you would be reading that script in your podcast. Advertisers like that because then their advertising message is coming from the host of the podcast, someone who listeners presumably trust. So that's one form of advertising. That's traditionally been advertising's entry point into podcasting. But what is increasingly happening in podcasting is that we're getting advertisements that are effectively dropped into podcasts. It's called programmatic advertising, and I spend some time later in the book talking about programmatic advertising. And programmatic advertising is when pre-recorded advertisements, digital advertisements, audio advertisements are inserted into podcasts at various moments, much like they are in traditional radio. And those programmatic ad spots are then inserted not just in one podcast, but potentially across hundreds or thousands of podcasts that are distributed through a major platform. This provides economies of scale, and it also dramatically expands the size of the audience who may be listening to an advertisement. And many in the industry see programmatic advertising as the future of monetization in the industry. The only problem is that in order to make programmatic advertising work, it's only available or accessible to those podcasts and podcasters that have a fairly large following. So with all due respect to the New Books Network, it would never be available to programmatic advertising because its audience is still way too small, right? In comparison with top podcasts like the Dax Shepard podcast or the Dave Ramsey podcast, right? So, but the nature of programmatic advertising is that it privileges these platforms, and they are central intermediaries. So what I end up arguing towards the end of the book is not that independent podcasting is going to go away or that RSS is going to fade into the background. It will always be there. It is a free and open ecosystem. But increasingly, podcasting will diverge into two different versions of the medium. The small startup indie version of the medium that relies on RSS for its distribution. And then what I call big podcasting, the big media stars, that the celebrities that have their own podcasts that are going to monetize through these new forms of monetization like programmatic advertising. And that's where the vast majorities of the revenue are going to be focused in the industry. So it's not that independent podcasters will not be able to be heard or get access to listeners, but increasingly they're going to be competing with big podcasting, which is going to kind of limit their ability to find and cultivate audiences into the future.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer again. So now, at the end of our episode, I want to directly talk to our audience, our listeners. So my dear listeners, I'm pretty sure you are still listening to this episode. But if you want not just listen to the podcast but also know what happened behind the podcasting, and you want to know the past, the present, and the future of podcast as both an industry and a medium. Please consider buying a copy of Dr. John Sullivan's newest book, Podcasting in a Platform Age. After reading this book, you must understand what happened behind this one, behind podcasting, not just as a media, also as an industry. So thanks so much for listening to our episode today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful. Thank you.